Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi. And welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. This week, I'm thrilled to welcome Andrew Wallace. Andrew is a journalist who has written about Central Africa for years, and he's particularly interested in the history of Rwanda and of the genocide. In 2014, he published his book, Silent Accomplice, The Untold Story of France's Role in the Rwandan Genocide. And now he's published a lengthy study on the origins and consequences of the genocide. The book is called Stepped in Blood, and in it, Andrew concentrates on the internal politics of the Rwandan regime, in particular, the accumulation of power by a small group of relatives and friends of the president. He does a fantastic job of tracing the regional and familial conflict, which destabilized Rwandan affairs and contributed greatly to the decision to adopt a strategy of genocide. It's a fascinating book. I'm really looking forward to our discussion about it. So, Andrew, with that, welcome, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks very much, Kelly, for that very kind and a generous introduction there. I'm looking forward to chatting about the book and indeed anything else that you want to ask me.
Wonderful. So before we start the book, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a journalist and how you got interested in Africa and Rwanda.
Sure. Well, it goes back a fair while, actually. I first went to Rwanda way back in 1990, as most people do then and indeed now, which is to see the fabled mountain gorilla of Diane Fossey fame. And when we got there, we discovered actually there was a civil war on, which we knew nothing about. The tour operator had forgotten to put that in the notes of what was happening. There was a little bit of a shock, and in fact, my friend I was with from university never even got to see the gorillas because he ended up under house arrest because he'd foolishly put journalist on his entry pass. So he never did get to see the mountain. I luckily did, and I would thoroughly recommend it to anyone. I think it's one of the top five things you'll ever do in your life. They are just incredible creatures. But a few years later, I ended up deciding to, having done degrees in history and then peace studies, I got involved in journalism. It started off just the usual local journalism, local paper. And then I sort of really, there was something telling me I needed to, I don't know, there's something fascinating about Rwanda. I did a master's degree, and during that I sort of began to look especially at this question of the role of France, which had really not been explored, which I found incredible. And the more I found out about the complicity of France before, during, and indeed after the genocide, the more I felt this needed to come out, really. And so I started writing there and sort of gave up the local journalism and became a freelance journalist and spent time to and fro Rwanda writing up on this subject. And I've been doing that ever since, I guess. So that's more than 20 years now.
So this is This is a really thoughtful, deep, rich book that must have taken you a long time to write. Why did you decide to write it?
Yeah, you're right about the length. It was meant to come out for the 2014 20th commemoration. It's just come out for the 25th. So we're a little bit, it's a little bit one of those over budget and over long and over everything, really. But there we go. It's best laid plans. It was an incredible. Well, it's taken 7 years, 8 years, really. And it's a fairly typical book in the sense that one lead has led to another, has led to another. And just when I'm thinking I'm getting to the heart of the issue, something else has turned up. And I've been exceptionally fortunate, given access to sources that really no one else has seen or come across yet, in terms of people who were there, who have not spoken before, in terms of intelligence reports, in terms of court reports, police reports, all sorts of information. And that has had a huge impact, really, because I've been able that the point, I suppose, of the book was there's a lot of books out there on the genocide, obviously a lot of very good books. But they do tend to sort of start in 1990 when the Civil War happened, and they end pretty soon after the genocide. So I was aware that really, you know, the genocide, men like Theoneste Bagosora didn't just land in Kigali in April 1994 when the genocide started and then disappear in July when it ended. He was around for decades before, as indeed was the regime. While this genocide and genocidal policy really was slowly, inevitably, it would seem, borne out. And also I wanted to take the story up to the current date because these individuals didn't disappear. They fled after the genocide. Some of them have faced justice. Some of them are still free, are still out there on our streets. And I wanted to raise some questions about the international, the various international support the genocidal regime got before, during, and indeed after the genocide, and questions I think which are highly significant today, but again have not really been tackled.
Well, let's start at the beginning, and maybe the beginning is to start at the beginning is to say something maybe about the importance of regional and family connections. So can you say something about the dynamics of politics in Rwanda after independence? How does politics work?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, in many ways, that's the nub of the question, because you need to understand that to understand 1994. Because 1994 happened because people were trying to protect what they had, as much as most people say, oh, this was a tribal event, it was an ethnic event. Actually, first and foremost, like most genocides, it was a political event. So at independence, you had this strange scenario where the Belgians had for the previous 40, 50 years of their colonial rule very much favoured the small Tutsi elite. And they effectively ruled through this group of the king, the chiefs, the sub-chiefs, about 1,000, 1,500 individuals. The rest of the country, both Hutu and Tutsi, were poor, were forgotten, were basically had very difficult lives indeed. At independence in about 1958, 59, the Belgians did a very swift volte-face. They worked out that the majority would indeed take power, and if they wanted any influence in the coming years, they needed to be on the side of the majority. So they they swiftly turned to support the Hutu majority, led by a man called Grégoire Kayibanda, who went on to become the first president. And Kayibanda was sort of formed by both the church, the Catholic Church, and Archbishop Perraudin, who was the leading cleric in the region, and also by the Governor General, a man called Haroy. And really, Kayibanda was, to some extent, a man who had been shaped by these Belgian individuals. However, as you go through the 60s, as Kayibanda took power, he really replaced the colonial power with his own one-party state. So many authorities would say, actually, the Rwandan people were no freer under Kayibanda than they had been under the colonial state. You had to be a member of this one party, Hutu Party, MDR Palmer Hutu, and really you had no freedom for anything else. Added to which, if you were Tutsi, there was a good chance you were going to struggle. Hundreds of thousands of Tutsi fled. When some attempted to come back, there were genocidal massacres, which Kayibanda both authorized and seemed to have organized in 59, 61, 62, 63, which the world, the UN, looked on and did nothing. And obviously 31 years later, we'd have the same history would repeat itself. So you've got really in the 60s, you've got this very small group which is from the majority Hutu party, but, and it's worth emphasising that Kayibanda, like his successor, was very much concerned with having his ministers and his government coming from this small area in the centre of Rwanda, Gitarama, a small dusty town in the middle of the country. So if you wanted to get on, you needed to be a Hutu and you needed to be from Gitarama. If you didn't really come up to those two, then you were going to struggle in Rwanda at the time.
And then you, of course, one of the people who managed to ascend to some level of power is his successor, Juvenal Habyarimana. Can you say a little bit about Juvenal and his wife, and I think I'm pronouncing this right, Agathe, and their families, and why their relationship and their family ties were so important?
Sure. I think, Habyarimana to me is a fascinating figure, far more so than, if I may say, the current Rwandan president who seems to tax so many people, and Habyarimana has been forgotten, but Habyarimana is a fascinating guy. He came from a very poor background. His father was given some land to sort of till the soil. And Habyarimana, as a young boy, was out there in the fields with his father at all hours, just trying to subsist. He first of all trained as a priest in a seminary. He then moved to train as a doctor in what is now the DRC. When the DRC at the time was going through its own independence and turbulence, he was effectively kicked out. He was recruited as recruit number one, in fact, of the new Rwandan army. Shortly after, basically around this time, he met a lady called Agathe Kanziga. Agathe was from the same area in the north of the country, the Bushiru area of Rwanda. They fell madly in love. They got married in 1962. And really, this couple are going to have this huge impact on Rwandan history. And not just them, but their family, because Rwandan society is very based around families, more so than we are in the West. And in that family, you had a series of highly ambitious individuals. Agathe herself, a highly ambitious individual. Her brother, a man called Proteas Zigwinyezu, who thankfully was known as Mushu Zed, or just Zed, a former school teacher. Zed was a man, if nothing, but ambitious. He knew what he wanted, and he wanted power, and he wanted wealth. And with this match, he felt his sister could bring it through his brother-in-law. Also, there was a man called Elisa Gatwa, Agat's cousin, and another individual, another cousin called Seraphat. Now, as time goes on into the 60s, it becomes clear that Habyarimana is getting restive. He quickly works his way up. Kayabanda trusts him. He becomes a godfather to his children. The two men get on very well. But it becomes clear that Kayabanda's regime is in trouble, as I said, basically because of the regionalism, because he just will not allow anyone from outside the Skitarama area to come into power. Habyarimana from the north, he gets restive, as do a number of the military who are also from the north. And in 1973, there is a coup. Kayabanda is pushed aside in a so-called bloodless coup. And quickly, Habyarimana, once he's in power, and certainly Agathe, make sure that in the coming years, sort of every part of Rwandan society becomes a sort of a prey to their ambitions and their sort of grasping thirst for wealth, really.
So let me ask a few questions, or more specific questions, about that period then. So, one question, what role does the church play in responding to or cooperating with Habyarimana in this period in the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, the church has an incredible hold on Rwandan society at the time. You have to imagine that this is a society where there's no television. There are not so many radios, and indeed there's only really one radio, state radio, Rwanda, which spends most of its airtime with programs praising the president. Not the most interesting thing to listen to after a hard day farming on the hills. So you're pretty short of entertainment there. Rwanda is also a highly authoritarian country in the sense that the authority system, whether you're a peasant in your home on one of the thousand hills, you are part of a cell, and the cell is part of a sector, and the sector is part of a commune. The commune comes under a mayor, the mayor comes under a sub-prefet, and then a prefet. So basically all the way up society, there's a sort of pyramid structure. And there is, you're born with a sense that you do as you are told. People above you are respected, and they know best. And the church is very much part of the structure. And the church is vitally important for the government, because where the government can't disseminate its wishes, today obviously you've got so many media and social media. Here you've got a society where at least half are illiterate. So they couldn't read a paper if they wanted to read a paper, but in fact there was only a state paper anyway, and really had almost no circulation outside the capital. It was difficult for the regime to get its feelings known, what it wanted. And so the church had a huge role, and it was the archbishops became appointees, really, of the regime. So for Habyarimana, he appointed a man called Vincent Zengyumva, who really had very little. He'd only been a priest for a few years. Suddenly he became archbishop. And almost as soon as he became archbishop in the mid-70s, he was put onto the central committee of this one-party state. Habyarimana had declared a one-party state. His one party was MRND. And you had the archbishop on that. So whereas everyone in society had to wear a little sort of a buttonhole pin with the president's face on it, the archbishop also wore this, as well as a crucifix, and you weren't quite sure whether his loyalties were to one or the other. But it did mean, you know, all the way down society, the local priests would be very much answering to the commands a bit further up, and people would obey what they were told. So the church is vital, and unfortunately it also reflects the society in general. So when things go badly, when famine begins in the country, the church, instead of doing much about it, stays silent. When genocidal massacres start at the beginning of the 90s, again, the church remained silent. The discrimination against the Tutsi minority, again, it is reflected in the church. Habyarimana doesn't make Tutsi bishops until right at the very end of his regime. There's an attempt to make one in the late 80s. There is a lot of opposition, and Habyarimana effectively gets the man sacked before he's even had a chance to take up his position as a bishop. So the church unfortunately reflects the regime rather than any sense of this, as you see in perhaps in the DRC today, as sort of a counterculture against the politics of the day.
So another follow-up question. In writing about Rwanda, at least I've found a tendency to suggest that ethnic relations became more stable and perhaps less prominent in Rwandan society under Habyarimana, and in contrast to the earlier president. What's your sense of the relationships between Hutus and Tutsis and the level of opportunity and freedom available to Tutsis under the Habyarimana regime?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think you're right in that assessment, really. I think under Kayibanda, the early years of Kayibanda, when some of the Tutsi refugees tried to come back, and there's this Kayibanda very cleverly uses really, it's a colonial era tactic, this sort of scapegoating, where the Hutu majority are getting restive, there's splits appearing, those in Gitarama, those in Butari, those in Gisenyi, different areas, there's signs of splitting. He, by aiming totally at this Tutsi minority, scapegoating it, he is able to sort of pull together the Hutus. It's, you know, unless you come behind me, then you're going to let the Tutsi back in. Before you know it, you'll be back under a king, and, you know, you'll have only yourselves to blame. When Habyarimana comes to power, he promises peace and unity regardless of region or indeed ethnicity. And you can certainly say in the years 73 to 90, ethnicity plays a very small part. You don't hear of Tutsis being locked up. You don't hear of pogroms or massacres. And really it's because the Tutsi minority at that point had been completely diminished in almost every area of society. So there is a number, a quota, which Tutsis are allowed to apply for jobs, which reflects their presence in society, about 13-14%. But in fact, in some areas, in the military, for example, there are no senior Tutsi figures. There is one colonel, but effectively no one else is able to go anywhere. As I said about the church, you know, an attempt to even make a Tutsi bishop was vetoed by the regime. But in terms of even going to primary or secondary school or university for a Tutsi, it was remarkably difficult. And unless you knew one of these, I'll use the term Akazu here for the first time, and I'll just say a little bit about who they were. The Akazu, which is really what my book centres on, was this small group around the president's wife. So an Akazu in Kinyarwanda is, it effectively means a small hut. And that is the familial hut where the family lives. And an Akazu is really this small hut of people. And that's where the power is in Rwanda under Habyarimana. Certainly with the president, but actually the Akazu is separate, I would say, in some ways from the president. It is about Agat and it's about Zed and Sofa and Sagatwa. And between them, they slowly allow power to drift down. There's other relatives are also members of this group. And it sort of comes down through society. So the job the Akazu can't get processed themselves, they give to subordinates, they recruit people. So all the way down through the church, through business, through the administration, mayors, prefects, sector leaders, all of them would answer to a figure going up this sort of mafia group, really. And the Akazu were effectively a parallel power. So you had the mainstream power that you'd expect, the government and ministers and the parliament. But actually the real power, as Rwandans knew all too well, was with this parallel, almost mafia group around Agat and around Zed. And they appointed their own people. If you're a businessman and you fell out with a member of a Akazu, your business could be shut overnight. You could be imprisoned. Indeed, to open a business, you would need to appoint probably one of these figures as shareholders. You would have to give them some of the profits for them to allow it to go forward. And the same is true if you wanted to be promoted, if you wanted to go to university. That's how it worked. But it didn't mean society really was based not on any sort of ability, but is purely based on your relationship with a member of this group of Akazu. And just like Kayabanda's Achilles heel was that he appointed purely from this central section of Rwanda around Gitarama, the Achilles heel for Habyarimana was he appointed from his Bushiru homeland in the north, near to the town, the border town of Gisenyi. So most of Akazu came from this small area. And again, the biggest problem, I think, to come back to your question, in the 70s and 80s was a regionalist one. So the Tutsi had been almost totally emasculated. The Hutu, however, had also, to an effect, been split and emasculated. If you came from Gitarama, if you came from the south, Butari, or the east, there was a good chance you too, just like the Tutsi, couldn't get any preferment in jobs or in business. You couldn't get your children to school or university because that was something reserved purely for the Bushiru, those who had Akazu godfathers, as it were, to support them.
So a lot of the time when you read accounts of the decision of Habyarimana to introduce a multi-party system, you read about pressure from the West. But the sense I get from your book is that actually there's as much internal pressure as external pressure, that the corruption involved in the government was creating or encouraging an economy that simply wasn't working. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, the whole area of the sort of international supporters tends to come in. For most critics, you know, they look in 1994, and obviously the first thing they look at is the failure of the UN swiftly followed by the failures of the US and the UK, and then obviously France comes in. What was interesting to me is looking back into the 70s and 80s, how the international actors who knew about the corruption of the regime and knew about the human rights abuses continued to push money and to support this regime, even though it was pretty dire in what it was doing. And you read reports being sent back from diplomats, and really there is no mention of some of these incredible abuses. And instead, you know, you've got Germany, Canada, France, Belgium, Switzerland, literally throwing money at a government. And yet, for example, after the 1973 coup, which Habyarimana was quick to send diplomats all around the world to say this was a bloodless coup, you know, Kayabanda, the president, is safe, and, you know, you can trust us. Actually, in the coming couple of years, probably 300-400 members of that Kayabanda regime, including the president and his wife, end up dead, some of them being tortured to death. Now, it's clear that the church knew this was going on, and it's clear that a lot of the Western powers knew this was going on, but obviously, for real politique, for the reasons of geostrategic policy, they were prepared to look the other way. And in the 80s, it's also clear that groups like the World Bank, which are pumping millions into Rwanda, knew that this was a country on the brink, and the old methods weren't simply not working. Habyarimana, as a peasant from the hills, was very much obsessed with an agrarian society. It was a, sort of similar to the sort of Khmer Rouge, really. He didn't trust any form of intelligentsia. He saw them as a threat. So by 1990, the only university only had about 3,000 in it. Secondary school attendance was also barely into the 20%. Illiteracy was extraordinarily high. And the fact was, that's something the regime wanted. The idea was that you worked on the hill, you subsisted on the hill in this agrarian economy, and that was your sole ambition, really. All fell apart in the late 80s when first the coffee prices dived, and this was effectively Rwanda's only real source of foreign currency. And secondly, a famine hit the south of the country, and people started to die. It took months for Habyarimana to make the 3-hour trip down into the south to see what was going on. But the World Bank knew about this. It knew that the millions being pumped into the economy, much of it was being diverted into the KAZU's own foreign bank accounts. And what little did get through was really going to the wrong part of the economy, as it were. It wasn't having any impact at all. It was just being swallowed up in short-term aid to try and keep the people alive. So that there's a big failure in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, where there is clearly information. Habyarimana had a number of very close contacts. There's a Swiss man called Charles Genet, who was presidential advisor, Peter Molt from the Rhineland-Palatinate from Germany, obviously the World Bank, as I've said, and the IMF. There are a number of individuals who are very close to the regime, advised the regime, but at no point seem to have said to Habyarimana, your policies, your agrarian policies, are not only not working, but if you continue with them, a large part of your population is going to be starving and unemployed, which is indeed what happens. And you get, in 1990, in a way, the perfect storm. At this point, the RPF decide, the Rwandan Tutsis who had fled abroad, hundreds of thousands of them in the previous 3 decades, decide, since Habyarimana won't let them back peacefully, that they will come back by force and they invade from Uganda. And at this point, it is a sort of perfect storm for Habyarimana. He's got famine, he's got the RPF launching a civil war. And to make matters worse, this is the point where a political opposition, mostly Hutu political opposition, are legalized. And he finds himself up against his own, in a way, his own people. And the question is, will he manage to out-Hutu the Hutu, as it were?
And so what is the relationship between Habyarimana and the other members of the Akazu, of Agat and Agat's relatives? And how does this increasing instability in politics affect that relation?
Well, it's a fascinating question, because what attracts me to Habyarimana is he's a very human individual in a way. And you can see he is less ambitious than his wife, he's less greedy than his wife, he's certainly less extreme than his wife. Having said that, he is all of the above. But maybe his version of extremism isn't quite as extreme as Akazu's. You know, at what point do you keep up this need for ambition, power and wealth? And what you see, I think, in the 90s is this perfect storm comes in and he is surrounded by enemies from every side. He's said that obviously the RPF, but he's clearly got enemies within the Hutu majority as well. Other parties which are either more extreme than his own MRND, like the CDR, though the CDR is very much linked to his own, or certainly those from the south and centre of the country who feel they've been marginalised in the previous 20 years of his rule. And he's got a large amount of unemployment. He's got this famine going on. He's got foreign donors who have suddenly got real to the fact that this money is not getting anywhere near where it should do, and corruption is basically killing the country. So Habyarimana as a person is very interesting, because you can see even pictures of him show how much he ages in just 2 or 3 years. Between 1990 and 1993, you've suddenly got this man who is falling apart at the seams. And you know, you've got the stories of the marriage slowly falling apart as well. Habyarimana going up to his hotel he owns on the hill at Ribeiro and actually being banned from entering by Agat. And so the president storming down the hill, and it takes the archbishop to come over and do some more marriage guidance counselling, which he seemed to do a lot of in the 90s. And Habyarimana himself had several illegitimate children. Indeed, he had a Tutsi mistress. So that was going on. There's rumours Agat also was having affairs. So it was not a happy family group by any means. And Habyarimana, 92, 93, is under so much pressure, it's quite clear, and he says it to people, including his own family, that he wants to get out. He's had enough. He can't take this pressure anymore. He's surrounded by enemies. And what's in it for him? He didn't become president for all this aggravation. He just wanted the sort of the power and the wealth. He certainly didn't want the pressure that's on him. And as you're getting into 92, 93, one of the biggest pressures is actually not just from the RPF, who are repeatedly attacking from the north as ceasefires, then they re-attack, and really they're only held back by Mitterrand's French troops. The biggest threat is coming from Hutu extremists around the military, Theoness Bagasora, but also from civilians, people like Joseph Serrera. And they make it clear, they spell out Habyarimana if there is any deal with the RPF, if there's any deal which in any way impedes on their power and their wealth, that he is going to be the first person to suffer. And Habyarimana, as I said, really, as a result, wants to get out. And it's clear he is warned by several people that his own life is at risk. And really, his assassination, when it comes, is not big news to anyone, because it people in Rwanda, both foreigners and Rwandans themselves, have had all seen this coming.
So we talk about the genocide starting in 1994, but you and others highlight the fact that Rwandan society had become a very violent place in the years since the beginning of the civil war. Where does that violence come from, and who's making the decisions to turn to violence as a strategy?
Well, it's clear within the RPF invade at the start of October in 1990. Within a week of that, you've got genocidal massacres taking place at a place called Kibilira, where several hundred Tutsi are killed, brutally killed. The local prefect is held responsible for it. But it becomes clear this is not a one-off. And in 1991, 92, 93, there are more and more of these genocidal massacres. There is an international inquiry. Both the UN launched one and a number of human rights organizations launched their own inquiry. And all of them blame the regime. So the people are making the decisions, the people are organizing, and the people are getting the killers to the place, making sure the local population is on board. This is all coming from Akazu. This is coming from this group around the president. And it's clear from the UN report and the human rights reports that this is the case. What is the point of these genocidal massacres? I mean, why in a way is the regime going to this length? Well, as we say, if you turn back history by three decades, this is exactly the same tactic Kay Banda used. He was under threat because of his own regionalist divisionism. Hutus were upset with him. So you target, you scapegoat the minority. And this is what happens in the early 90s. In a way, the biggest danger from Habyarimana is not from the RPF, it's from his own side. It's from the Hutu in the south and in the centre of the country, who were deeply unhappy with him, who also held him responsible for the murder of Kay Banda, who they saw as the real Hutu leader all those years before. So the idea is, if you suddenly say the Tutsis are a threat, a real threat, if we don't stop them, if we don't come together as the majority, before you know it, there'll be a new Tutsi kingdom. The RPF is just part of a huge effort to have Tutsis take over not just Rwanda, but the whole region, and bring in an Anglophone culture, a foreign culture into the country. So you're convincing local people that really it's dog eat dog. Either you target your Tutsi neighbours, who you've lived alongside all your life, and indeed there's plenty of intermarriage, you speak the same language, you go to the same church, your children play at the same school. But either you target them, or there's a good chance that the sort of fifth column within society will eventually launch an attack. And before you know it, you'll be back to the 1930s of Hutu serfdom to Tutsi overlords. And this narrative plays very, very successfully in areas. So these genocidal massacres, while they are a political risk, there's a risk that they will alienate some of Habyarimana's international supporters, as they do. Belgium, for example, is alienated by it. France continues to stay on Habyarimana's side, and in a way that gives him the leverage to continue with this tactic.
So, excuse me, Habyarimana's plane is shot down. How does it happen that the decision is made to move from genocidal massacres to genocide?
Well, as I said, for me, Habyarimana Mana is never the fully fledged extremist that Bagasura wanted. And really what you have on the 6th of April 94 is really the same as you have in early July 1973. That is a military coup. Bagasura effectively, important members, not just Habyarimana, of the regime die on the plane, most notably the Army Chief of Staff. It's very unusual for an Army Chief of Staff to travel on the same plane as a president for security reasons, but this happens and both of them die. It means effectively that Bagasura, who was a sort of, he was at that this point really a civilian, quickly gets back into his army fatigues and is able to effectively seize control. When this doesn't come about quite as he wants, his idea was clearly to have a military regime put in place. When the United Nations makes clear that this is not acceptable to them, then Bagasura goes to Plan B, which is to put into place a hand-picked Hutu extremist government, so-called Hutu power, which is the extreme elements of the Hutu opposition parties. And they effectively do his bidding in the following 100 days. And Bagasura, though, is the real power behind them.
As you said earlier, one of the real contributions of your book is that you pursue the story after the defeat of the Rwandan the fleeing of the Rwandan government to outside of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. So how did the leaders of the Rwandan government leaders, Bagasura and others, how do they respond to the RPF's victory? What is their hope in fall of 1994 and early 1995?
Well, I mean, it's to me, this is another fascinating area which has sort of been avoided because you get into July and what is clear that the French sent an intervention force into the south of the country, so-called Operation Turquoise, which is meant to save the Tutsi, but in fact, there's very few Tutsi left by then to save. But the biggest impact of this French force is to allow the not just a lot of refugees, innocent Hutu and indeed some Tutsi, to flee across the border into Tanzania, Zaire, and Burundi. But it allows the interim government, this genocidal government, to flee en masse, along with the Interahamwe militia, who had done most of the killing, and indeed Bagasura's army. So they go across the border, and for the next 3 or 4 years, and indeed to some extent some of them are still there today, they are there, they're rearming, they're retraining, and their tactic is they want to come back in, they want to invade Rwanda and to seize power again. And so you get these huge refugee camps, UN refugee camps. Almost every aid agency in the world, it's a sort of a camp of 1,000 aid agencies, is there suddenly interested in helping out. But of course, you know, they're helping out not just the innocent, but the guilty. And some like MSF in the end say, look, we can't continue here. We're feeding the killers. We are clothing the killers. And the money we're giving to refugees is just actually not going to refugees. The killers are taking it and using it to rearm and to launch genocidal attacks back into Rwanda. So in the years afterwards, once the International Criminal Tribunal is set up in late 94, slowly it becomes clear that this invasion is never going to happen. And the proponents of the genocide then decide they need to make themselves scarce. And slowly they move away from the region. Some of them come to the West, or they come to Europe, they come to the US, North America, Canada. New Zealand, in order to live a comfortable life. All of them have embezzled millions of dollars. Most of them are not strapped for cash. So it's a nice, quiet retirement. Some of them have been, international justice has caught up with some of them, notably Bagasura. And the highly controversial court, the International Criminal Tribunal, which has cost about $2.5 billion over its years. It's controversial. It's done some wonderful things in the sense that it has got hundreds and thousands of gigabytes worth of documentation, which has been so important moving forward to block the growing revisionist denial conspiracy theories, which unfortunately seem to come after every genocide from the Holocaust onwards. So the International Court has been very important in for that. But in terms of handing out meaningful sentences, I think most people in Rwanda would say it's been pretty disastrous. Men like Anatole Zengyumva, for example, the so-called butcher of Gisenyi, who was so thorough that all the Tutsis in the region, probably 100,000 plus, had died within the first few weeks. He got a life sentence at trial, and then the highly controversial appeal judge, Theodore Meron, slashed this down to 15 years, and he was released. And Meron has done that to more than a dozen other cases as well. So the court has been, that has been a bit of a problem, to say the least. And also, you know, you're looking at a world now where probably at least 600 genocidaire are still out there living in various communities, mostly in the West. And there is a sense of sort of fatigue, apathy. Genocide apathy when it comes to actually governments taking seriously the Genocide Convention to prevent and punish. They didn't prevent, and it's a moot point whether they have managed to punish. So many of these individuals are still out there and free, and I think often for domestic reasons, notably finance, these trials are remarkably expensive to put on. If you've got to try someone in a European country, you've got to send investigators all the way to Rwanda to find the witnesses, to get all the documents translated. It is expensive. And that, clearly at a time of sort of austerity, is making many governments renege on their ratification of the Genocide Convention. And do nothing. I mean, I'm in my own country, the UK, it's highly unfortunate. In fact, since 1948, you know, the Genocide Convention came into being. In 70 years, the UK has not managed to prosecute a single person for genocide. And in that time, has only prosecuted one for war crimes, despite being home to probably hundreds of war criminals in those 70 years. So there's a lot to be thought about, and the book I hope will raise this issue of international justice, because it's clearly important. You know, there are so many points where Habyarimana's Amarna's regime could have been held to account in the 70s and in the 80s and in the early 90s, even before the genocide happened. And then after the genocide happened, there were so many chances for this regime to be arrested and charged. Instead, they were allowed to escape, to destabilize the region, and then to come to often very pleasant retirements in the West, where we've just allowed them to continue to live with pretty much total impunity.
Well, we've taken a lot of your time, but I would like to pull back and just ask a little bit different kind of question. I know you were just in Kigali and in Rwanda, or at least at the same time as the 25th, I guess, anniversary. What did you see there? How was the genocide remembered? What was your impression of that experience?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fairly regular visitor. I've been going sort of two or three times a year for many years, probably years, sometimes a little bit more. But I think the 25th commemoration did mark what was interesting as opposed to other commemorations was the sense of here is a country very much with a future as well as a past. And it was commemorating the past, but also building on that past. And an idea that we need to remember the past in order to move forward with the present and the future. We can't just, obviously Rwanda today is sort of going places really in terms of peace and security. I know people have issues with areas of democracy or media freedom, and one hopes that they will come as peace and security continue in the country. But I think most importantly, it's remembering where Rwanda was 25 years ago, and it was, I'll use the word ground zero, because I think that sums it up really. This was a country where, of a million inhabitants, of 8 million inhabitants, a million were dead. Maybe up to 2 million had fled. And those who were left were highly traumatized, either by what they'd done, what they'd seen, what they'd suffered. Ministers spent a couple of years, there were no light bulbs, there was no exchequer, there were no cars. Ministers were going about on bikes for the 2 years after the genocide. You know, it's building on top of that has never been done before. And I think the expectation was Rwanda would just become yet another failed African state, like Somalia, Central African Republic, Sudan, where it never quite manages to function again. So the fact Rwanda does function today as well as it does, even though it's clearly got a whole way to go, is quite impressive. But in a way, it's moving forward with the knowledge of such a painful past, not just of 94. And I hope the book sort of spells out that it goes back, a couple of generations before that. It's building on the pain of the colonial period, building on the terrible pain of Kayibanda's First Republic, and building on the pain and suffering and the marginalisation of the 70s and 80s and the early 90s, where no one was free and life was just a whole bunch of suffering, really, with not much to look forward to. So, Kigali today, it's a young place. So many people there. Obviously, you need to be aged above 25, and a lot of the population aren't. It's a very young population, a vibrant population. And I think that'll be interesting to see moving forward. So for the 30th or the 35th commemorations, how they play out as the history becomes that much more remote. And I think it is important to remember where Rwanda has come from to understand where it's going.
Well, it's a terrific book, and I learned a lot, as I said. And I encourage people to go get it and read it and learn from it as well. I always end these interviews with the same two questions, and so I'll end our discussion with those. And the first one is, and we talked about this in the chat before the interview, I'm leaving for Europe. I've got some amount of time on planes and trains that I don't want to think about now. What book or possibly film or documentary or something, what should I read on that trip that was meaningful to you while you were writing this book?
Well, I'm a huge fan, and I've come to him fairly late in the day, but I've discovered him, and I'm slowly getting through his books of the Austrian Jewish writer, who I'm sure you know well, called Joseph Roth. Joseph Roth was so an Austrian Jew. It's difficult to say where he's from because he spends his life living out of suitcases. He's the most incredibly wonderful journalist. He sees everything. I mean, he's an alcoholic. He is, one person said, he's a vagabond. He's a liar. He's he never had a single book. He never read any of his own books. But the most incredible eye, and I suppose his one major work, the Radetzky March. He always looks back, and that's what I love about him. He looks back into this sort of era. He's writing in the late 20s, 30s. The Habsburg Empire, the sort of the tail end, how this Habsburg Empire, Emperor Joseph, Franz Joseph, it all slowly unravels towards the end, and this halcyon days before the First World War. But I would certainly, I think, and if you get into the Radetzky March, you will certainly start to read through his other books, because I think he's an incredible writer. The poignancy of what he's writing, the sense of a world unraveling, and he can't quite make sense of it, is wonderful. And you know, unfortunately, he committed suicide in Paris. He was forced into exile by the Nazis, and he committed suicide. And unfortunately, his wife also had some mental health issues, and she was targeted for the euthanasia program by the Nazis. So a fairly tragic individual, but his work is, I would say, quite wonderful.
That seems particularly appropriate given my travel schedule with Vienna and Krakow on the list, and possibly Budapest. So, and then I always end the same way. Do you have another book in the works? I know that you said this one took you a little time. Are you working on another one about Rwanda or something else, or what's your future plans?
Well, it's an interesting question. I'm sort of drawing breath after this one. After the first one on France, I swore never again, and somehow 7 years later, the sensible thing would be to say never again. But writers being what they are. Actually, an area, another book which I would sort of recommend, which is I found really interesting, is the diary by a Polish teenager, Dawid Sierkowiak. And to many in Poland, they would say he is the equivalent of Anne Frank. He was writing while in the Lodz ghetto. And his diary is quite an incredible piece of work. Unfortunately, it tails off towards the end, and David died in the ghetto, as did 70,000 or 80,000 others, basically starved to death. But his diary over the 3 years, 41 to about 43, is such a moving but incisive. This is a young individual with an incredible mind. He seemed to speak about four languages. He seemed to know philosophy and theology. And it's an incredible diary of seeing what he saw around him in the ghetto, being able to observe and to analyze what was going on, and obviously facing his own demise and that of his family while he was there. So, that I'm thinking of. I spent February walking around the ghetto area in Lodz, and so I'm that's could be the next area for some research. We'll see how it goes. Non-committal.
Well, if that happens, we would love to have you on the show again. But I want to say thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and. And I hope that we get a chance to chat again.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Kelly, for listening, for your questions. And it's been a joy to talk.
You've been listening to an interview with Andrew Wallace about his new book, Stepped in Blood, Akazu and the Architects of the Rwandan Genocide of the Tutsis. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers, or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I'll talk with Paul Thomas Chamberlain about his new book, The Cold War's Killing Fields. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.